Hello and welcome. Today I am joined by Dr. Ian Beasley, who is a consultant sport and exercise medicine physician and is also the relatively recently appointed doctor at AFC Bournemouth. Ian, how are you doing?
Yeah, fine, thank you. Nice to see you.
Likewise. So, yeah, talk to me about how the, I didn't actually know this until we came on camera. So how did the Bournemouth appointment come about?
Oh, well, Craig Roberts has left at the end of December and has gone back to South Africa. I'm only doing this whilst they recruit a new full-time doc. I'm not gonna suggest that I could work in football full-time from now on. But it's been sort of fun being back. I'm supposed to be here till March. And, you know, I was saying earlier that football hasn't changed that much, really. The technology's changed and lots of sports science has changed. But most of the time, it's just organisation and governance, you know, trying to make sure we're safe as a for players, staff and club.
Yeah. And so what's it like going back into when were you last involved with football then?
Well, I think I worked for a year between 2017-18 at West Ham. And then 2019, I went over to work at Aspetar in Qatar and did a bit of football stuff over there. But obviously, that's not the same as here. But all that time, really, ever since I left the FA, which is 2016, I've been working with City Football Group. Recently, Daniel Broman, who people may know, has taken over most of that job. But I've been doing things like their governance, signing medicals, and giving advice to the teams that they have around the world. You know, they've got 10 or 12 teams around the globe. So speaking to them, advising them on stuff. So not day to day, but still involved.
And so how does something like that come about then? How do you get that role?
Which one?
The Bournemouth one.
Oh, well, it's a really strange business. Scott McAllister, who was my boss at City Football, is head of therapies here. And so he came to see me when he came down and got his job here, beginning of the season. He just came down and said, oh, what's it like living around here? And then Jay Millette, who's the performance director, was at Cirque du Soleil and then was at the Las Vegas Knights ice hockey team. I met him at the Royal Ballet about 10 years ago. He came to give a talk to the medical and physio staff at the Royal Ballet, and I was there. So I'd met Jay before. So it was a sort of strange coincidence, really. And, you know, they're scraping the bottom of the barrel, aren't they? Because, you know, I was round the corner and it seemed easy. And, you know, look, I like being back in football. It's, you know, it's not like proper work to me. I mean, I'm not living in Gaza. I'm not working down a coal mine. I'm in an environment that, you know, I like. It's great sitting on the bench. I get a buzz every time still. But, you know, I'll have to stop eventually.
That's great, isn't it? It's just it's privilege, isn't it, being able to do that and be excited about it as well.
It is. I'm lucky.
Great. And so then starting off then, so where are you from originally?
Oh, I'm from Hackney in East London.
Right. And then at what point then, so was like Hackney, what was Hackney like? I've actually been watching some gangland stuff now and being very stereotypical, but what was it like in Hackney?
Well, you know, because I'm very old now, so I was sort of, so I'll tell you this, but you know, so I used to deliver papers to the block of flats where the Cray twins lived, but I didn't know they were there. I didn't know anything about them. You know, I was just a young 15-year-old. I liked football and music. You know, we lived in a council estate in Hackney and that's all we ever did. I left school when I was 17, didn't have any exams or anything really. And I got back into education when I was 24. I left work and just worked part-time weekends and holidays and did an A-level course and got into medical school from there. So I was very lucky, got a second chance. I couldn't do it now because I couldn't possibly afford to do that. I didn't have any support. I had to do all that myself. So, like I said, I was lucky to get a second chance. But these days, it wouldn't be possible.
So how then did you go from wanting to do medicine?
Well, I didn't really. I went to do these A-levels and, you know, I didn't have English O-level. I didn't have physics O-level, but I did maths, phys and chem A-level. And I only just sort of scraped into the further education college in Hackney. And I sort of, at the end of the first year, I was doing really well. And they said, why don't you apply for medicine? And I said, do me a favor. I'm never going to be able to do medicine, you know, someone like me. And but, you know, I applied and got rejected because, you know, I didn't have any exams backing me up. And then when I got my results, I got in through clearing. So I had two interviews in a day. I had St. Bartholomew's Hospital in the morning, Barts, and then London in the afternoon. Barts offered me a place, so I took it. And that was it, really.
Did you have any aspirations of what you wanted to do once you'd gone down that path?
No, not really. You know, to be honest with you, I was so pleased to be at medical school, and so I couldn't believe it. I mean, when my wife said to me the other day, what did you think when you first went to medical school? I said, I was like a fish out of water. I didn't, you know, everybody else had high academic qualifications. They were all really clever people. I'd never met anybody who had been to private school, who had been privately educated until I went to medical school. I'd never met anybody like that. So it was all completely new to me, and I felt really out of place and, you know, not up to it. But, you know, it sort of worked out okay. I did really well as a student. I was in the top 25 of 120, and I, you know, was captain of the football team. I was secretary of student union, did other stuff as well as study. So, you know, I was a crammer. So I used to cram stuff for 6 weeks before exams, and then I used to just do what I wanted to the rest of the time. But I turned up. I always turned up.
Well, and got involved in other stuff by the sounds of it as well.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, I think when you're a student, you don't realise before you go what opportunities there are to do things, you know, to get involved. And like I said, to meet people from different parts of the country, different backgrounds. And you know what? It turns out we're all very, very similar.
And so how was that experience at university then?
Yeah, it was good. I had a great time. And, you know, exam time is always precious and pressure, lots of, you know, learning things off by heart. But, you know, like I enjoyed turning up. I enjoyed being on the wards and the interaction with patients. And, you know, I still think that for me, clinical signs are fantastic. You know, if I can elicit a clinical sign, I'm always interested and enthusiastic about it. And I've always been the same. It's a really funny thing. I trained as a GP in the 80s, and even when I was a GP, if I listened to someone's heart and heard a murmur, I loved every minute of it. It's a really strange thing, but that's what I like doing.
And so in the different placements that you were doing then, did that give you a good idea of what you wanted to go into from there?
No, I, you know, because I was older than everybody else really in my year, I sort of thought, I better go into general practice. So I got on a general practice training scheme, the Hackney General Practice Training Scheme. You know, I was so I stayed in East London really, and I was doing that, and then I saw this advert for a scholarship to study sports medicine at London, and I thought, oh, that looks good, you know, I'd like footy, and but I was in the middle of doing something else, and then when I was doing my GP training, I saw the advert again and applied. And I applied and got an interview, and they gave me a scholarship to do this 1 year course at the Royal London, which was the first ever course. And that was in 1986. So I stopped, you know, I left work, did that course, then had to go back and do some more of my GP training. There was a bit of an argument about it. And then I've been doing sports medicine part-time or full-time ever since, really. I did a postgrad diploma in palliative medicine. So when I was in general practice, I used to look after people dying at home, which again, I found very rewarding and you know, very, very interesting.
And then, so in terms of that sports medicine, who were the other people that were on that? And like, what was the dynamic of that course? Because it was quite ahead of its time, I guess.
Yeah, Tom Crisp was there. Roger Hackney, who's a surgeon in Leeds, I think. Guy called Noel McCaffrey, who was a Gaelic footballer from Dublin, and you know, quite a few other people who scattered around the world. Really, every now and again, I see someone on the TV and think, "Oh yeah, I remember." I was at a hockey tournament when I was the hockey doc in Australia. One of the guys from the course that I was on turned up was a pitch side dock. So, you know, you bump into these people every now and again. It's a strange, it's a relatively small world, but a strange sort of place, really.
Yeah. And then, so what opportunities did that bring, having done that, that scholarship?
Well, part of the, we used to, it was a funny sort of course, really, and it wasn't, it didn't really have a curriculum as such. It just had loads of people coming in and lecturing on what they thought was interesting in sport. And one of the things we did, there was sort of outreach clinic. So I used to go to the physio clinic at Lake Norian. So the physio there, Bill, he used to run a private clinic twice a week in the evenings. And that used to happen a lot in football. Physios used to run their own private clinic and make a little bit of money on the side. And, you know, patients would go and see them because their reputation was they were the local football physio. So I used to go and help Bill out. And then after that, I wrote to him and said, oh, if you need any help, you know, on a Saturday, let me know. So I started kind of working at Lake Norian. Really, there was a dock there and I just used to turn up and sit around and not do very much, really. But, you know, that's when I got into football. So that's 37 years ago this year.
And so how, when you say you got involved, how much time were you doing in that? And what were you doing with the rest of your working
rest of my life. By this time, I was a partner in a general practice in Newham. And Newham's interesting place, really. Lots of old, then there were lots of old fashioned blue collar workers, big Asian population, lots of refugees from places like, you know, East Africa, I had one patient who had half a leg blown off by a mine. She used to come and see me. And so lots of different patients, but I used to do Lake Norian on a Saturday, all home games and all home reserve games. And I used to go once a week. At that same time, I was working at the London on a Wednesday afternoon doing a sports clinic. I used to go to Crystal Palace and work there on the weekend. What I tried to do really was get as much experience as I could, because then there weren't loads of sports medicine outlets. So anything you got a chance to do, you know, you had to go and do it or just lose what skills you'd picked up. And I realized that, I haven't realized very much in my life, but I realized that. And so anything that came up that I could do, I did. And I went part-time general practice in the early 90s and then gave up general practice at the end of the 90s and been doing sports medicine ever since. You know, and at that time, a lot of us just scratched around for a living in sports medicine, because there wasn't any training, there wasn't anything formal at all, really. We were just, you know, like I said, doing clinics where we could, attached to sports teams, relatively low pay in those days. I mean, when I was at Lake Norian, the club secretary used to come, I used to sit up in the stand. You know, no one sat on the bench in those days. And he'd sit up in the stand and they used to come and give me a little brown envelope with 40 quid in it. That was my fee for the day. So, you know, which was fine. You know, I mean, I was relatively inexperienced. And you know what? I was doing what I wanted to do. So I didn't really care about that. Still don't really care about that very much. But anyway, I mean, I think that, you know, what Bill Songhurst, who's the physio, gave me was, you know, he taught me loads of stuff. He was a physio who'd done the FA 2-week course, but he was very bright, very able, a good diagnostician, and really good with people. And I still see him. He's older than me, which is saying something. And I still see him and we, you know, go and have lunch together. I pay, of course, as you can imagine. But yeah, I learned a lot from Bill. I owe him a lot, really.
And so what opportunities did that bring from having done that time at Leighton Orient then?
Well, from there, I went and worked at Chelsea, which was a real, I think about it now, it's a real leap. That was at the time when it was between Matthew Harding getting killed in a helicopter and Abramovich taking over. But they had big players then. They had Desailly, Leboeuf. They had the French World Cup winners. I mean, it was a fantastic team. Dennis Wise was there, of course. And they were big time, some of them were world players, and it was quite a leap to go from Leighton Orient to there. But again, you know, I think I learned a fair bit and learned how to deal with big time players. You know, it's it's sort of slightly different. And but it was good, you know, going to away games with a big team and everything. That was the first I've been working in hockey for years, and whenever we went abroad and we went to World Cups and Olympics, we always, me and the physio always shared a room. Well, when the first time I went away with Chelsea, I had my own room. It's unbelievable. Couldn't believe it. We're in this posh hotel and I have my own room. Because now I'm Billy big time and I always expect that. But in those days, I sort of didn't. And I thought, wow, this is, you know, that's what big time football is. And they had a proper chef at the training ground. And, you know, and I was there for a couple of years. Then Luca Vialli, I went to work with Luca Vialli at Watford. And he left Chelsea and went to Watford. I went and worked with him. And that was fun. But we all got the sack at the end of the first year. He was there. Results weren't good. He got the sack. I got the sack. I was his man. So that was that. And then went to work at Fulham with Charlotte Cowie. We shared that job while she was pregnant. And afterwards. And then I went to Arsenal, then England, then West Ham. So, you know, it was, I mean, no one's been more lucky than me, and that's all I can tell you.
So going back to Chelsea then at that time, so it's relatively early into the Premier League, there's loads of money coming in, and like, what was the dynamic in the medical setup then? Because, I mean, I remember speaking with Gary Lewin about this, and he was telling me the team that went to Anfield when they won the old Division League. One, as it was, and he's like, I couldn't believe it. It was like there's a team of four like behind the scenes or something there. I just think it's an incredible story. So what was it like when you were at Chelsea in terms of the setup of the medical side?
Yeah, well, there was, I think there were two or three physios and a couple of masseurs. And we used to share the away games between three of us, and we all went to the home games. But Hugh Millington, who was an A&E consultant and still works at Chelsea, and he's still older than me. I saw him when we went to Luca Vialli's memorial game. So he used to be the chief doc there, and he appointed me. So, but yeah, there weren't that many. And it's so funny you should say that. I was saying the other day, every team now has two coaches to go to games. That wasn't the case in those days. There weren't that many people that traveling with the team. And some managers like a very small staff. Some managers like to take everybody they can. I know when I was at England, I think the Bolton management liked to take everybody they could. And when you saw their bench on a match day, there were people standing because they couldn't get them all on the bench. Whereas when I was at Arsenal, Arsene Wenger, the least amount of people possible, the better to him.
Yeah, it's really interesting the way that different managers run certain things. So at Chelsea then, so who was the manager when you went in there?
Well, it's Rud Hullett was the manager. And Rud Hullett is, again, really interesting. I bumped into him when I was in Qatar. But so Rud was very interesting. And, you know, these people are just, they're world superstars. And it's a really interesting thing to watch how these people are. And how they not behave, but just how they exist almost. So he was, he expected, I think, expected a lot of his players and wanted them to understand inherently what he was after. But I remember he was sort of player manager on the bench, and we went to Anfield and played. And someone got sent off, and he came on as a sub to play at the back. And it was almost like all of a sudden the pitch was only half the size, because he could do anything and the ball would go exactly where he wanted. And it didn't matter if it was 10 yards away or 50 yards away. It just did what he wanted it to. It was a funny experience that. And then so he left, of course, and I've seen him on the TV talking about when he got the sack. And that was when Luca Vialli took over. And again, Luca, very strict and you know, very certain about what he wanted and didn't want. And then, of course, I was there when Ranieri started. So I was only there for a couple of years, but the whole world changed, really, while I was there. I remember, so Ranieri had his very close-knit coaching team. So, and that was slightly different from how it had been with Luca and Ray Wilkins at that time.
Mm. So look, you've got Viali and Hulle, two absolute iconic players, just massive, like particularly, well, both of them really, that Hulle really was World Player of the Year. When you've around those people, because you've got superstars there anyway, but these guys are superstars within the world of football as well. Yeah. What is there anything different that you see about them, or are they in any way different?
Well, it's interesting. So I always think those tip-top superstar players have something about them. And I don't know, don't ask me what it is, because I don't know what it is. But I sort of know when I see it, and I know when I don't see it, I think. And what's really interesting, so, you know, when I was with Arsenal and Thierry Henry was there, he had this aura. And actually, you know, I was working at the Royal Ballet until a couple of months ago, and I've been there for nearly 20 years. And Carlos Acosta, who's that famous ballet dancer from Cuba, he had this. He walked in the room and everyone knew what was going on. And it was, and there's a ballerina at the Royal Ballet who's from Argentina, and she has the same aura. It's a funny thing, and like I said, don't ask me what it is, but I know when I see it or feel it. They don't do anything any different than anybody else. They don't act any different. They're not aloof. It's just a different feel.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like Desai was another absolute global star as well. So after you'd done those things, like you mentioned, you'd gone to Watford. But how did that the England role? I don't know if I've skipped over anything there, but how did the were you at Arsenal for a bit as well then?
Yeah.
So with how long were you at Arsenal for?
6 years.
6 years. Yeah. And did you do it concurrently as well at England as well?
No, I didn't. I didn't do England at the same time. And that was at a time when Alex Ferguson was agitating that the Arsenal medical staff were the same as the England medical staff. And he thought that, you know, there was feedback to the Arsenal management about their players. And of course, that wasn't true. But, you know, it's all about perception, isn't it? So that's when, you know, I've been at Arsenal. And look, I'm an Arsenal supporter. I'm from that part of London. And I didn't really want to leave Arsenal, but I applied for the England job and got it. And, you know, you can't turn it down. You know, you think it might turn up again, but you never can tell. So you get a chance to do that sort of thing, go to a World Cup, you can't say no.
So what year was that, Ben? What?
So I was at Arsenal from I was just thinking this morning. I was at Arsenal from 2003, I think the Invincibles year, until 2009. So it will be, 14 years, I think, next month that I started at England.
Right. So then just for Arsenal, because again, that is an absolutely epic team, and that Invincibles season. It was just amazing to watch. I remember just seeing that with Vieira and obviously Henri. Just, well, the whole team, you could pretty much name the team now. And like, what was it like to be around that? And obviously having Wenger there as well.
I always say big men, big players. You know, great self-belief, and, you know, just when they ran on the pitch, you didn't think they were going to lose. And I think that I felt that because that's how they felt. They didn't think they were going to lose. And they, you know, I used to come in at halftime and say, proper football, what I call proper football.
Yeah, but they got the combination of strength, aggression with like the speed and skill. It really was. It was such a shame that they didn't get the Champions League. Was that? It was 06, was it, the Champions League?
06, yeah. Yes, Lehmann got sent off. But I think it's really funny. One of the guys here who's in senior management played against them. And I think I must have been pitch side. And he said, you know, how difficult it was to play against them tactically. But they were all very strong physically, mentally, and able, you know, technically, and it makes life very, very difficult. And I think, you know, that's what it was like. And yeah, Arsene Wenger, you know, he I don't know really. He was very, he had a light touch on the controls. How do you like that? That's probably the way. But he knew exactly, he knew his players, spoke to his players. He knew exactly, and he had a different way of doing stuff. He would say, you know, like, you'll know some managers will say, oh, you know, I want so-and-so to play and this, that, and the other. And he would say, look, if this player doesn't feel he can play, I don't want him in the team. So that's, you know, and that was then. This is 20 years ago. This isn't yesterday. So it's a different way of, and, you know, the medical room at the training ground, you know, looked out onto the training pitches. And so a lot of managers will say, oh, you know, we want the medical room to be the worst place in the building so that players don't want to be there. He would say, well, I just want players to see what they're missing. So it's a slightly different way of looking at things. But, and, you know, look, if we lost, you know, and after that year, yeah, we lost a few games. But if we lost, the coach ride home wasn't much fun. So, you know, don't think that he took those, him or Pat Rice took losing lightly, because neither of them did. And like I say, it was an unpleasant ride home, but not in a malicious way, just that's what losing meant to them.
Yeah, I mean, I always see with some of those, again, talking about the players, but the managers, they're just the top managers seem like you could put them into any business, like Klopp, Guardiola, Wenger, Ferguson, and they just would be, they've got that leadership, I guess, is what it is, just natural leadership. What was your experience around that for those people?
Yeah, I think you're right. Ancelotti is the one currently that comes to mind. You know, he can get the best out of footballers. And when you speak to people that have been managed by him, you know, again, they're not really sure what it is, but they know what it isn't, that it is about him. So, you know, again, these people, they're, you know, Arsene Wenger used to choose what veneer there should be on the doors for the Emirates, you know, and I, from what I hear of about what happened to Man United, it was a very similar situation. You know, it was all or nothing. These days, there's a move away from that, and I understand that. I mean, if you go to Arsenal, it's not like it was at Highbury when I first started. It's a massive, massive concern. There's no way that the team manager could coach a team these days and do all that other stuff. But that's what it used to be like. They used to run everything in the club, but not now. You know, very much it's, you know, here's a team, you coach the team. And quite often they don't even get a say in who they sign. So, you know, the whole way of doing things has changed. And I don't know if it's for the better or for the worse. I just think that football's a business. I always say to people, you know, we sit up in the stand and watch it. It's not the same game as I used to play on Hackney Marshes. It's not. You know, this is the entertainment business, and it's a business. And, you know, if you want to see the best players playing here, the business has to be successful. Otherwise, you know, go and watch me on Hackney Marshes.
Yeah, well, no, I'll be interested in that as well, actually. But, yeah, it's... I would say, from my own personal preference, I think the late 90s and the noughties, whatever you want to call it, that was just a perfect era. I don't know if it's to do with my age, but I think it did have that thing of you could really relate to the players, but also they took it on to that next level, particularly Arsenal and Man United. It was just like, this is just, it was different then, but it still had that. Like, I remember the United Arsenal game, which you were probably at Highbury. The 4-2, I think, and it's just like, just that game was just probably not as good for you guys because you lost, but it was just an epic match to watch.
And that draw when Van Nistelrooy hit the bar with a penalty, you know, it is a bit different now. I mean, it seems as if it was more gladiatorial then than it is now.
It but, certainly, you know, was, I mean, for Martin Keown. So, yeah, you were doing that game then. So what was that like after the? Because that, I mean, that must be some insight into that, because that was pretty epic.
Well, you know, it's like a lot of things, really. I think when you're, for me anyway, I'm just talking about my experience, I suppose. For me, it was, I didn't really understand what I was seeing sometimes. You know, I didn't understand how good the football was. I knew it was good, but looking back, it always seems as it was much, much better than it really was at the time. And that game was like that. You know, I saw all that stuff going on. I didn't really quite understand what it was. But when you see it now on the TV, or you reflect on what it was and people talk about it, you think, well, you know, it was quite something to be there. Although exactly how it all worked out and stuff like that, I just don't know. Like I said, I think that there was real needle between those two teams, and you know, created in part by the media and, you know, looking at the two managers and stuff like that. I mean, it was a great rivalry, really.
Yeah, no, it was. I loved it because I'm an Everton fan, so I was neutral, but it's just was, yeah, amazing to watch all of those things. Really, yeah, we'd be genuinely excited, which does feel like we've lost a little bit of that now. Those rivalries don't seem to be quite as intense.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I don't know. Again, you know, you're right. I don't know if it's just, you know, if you're getting older and you've seen so much of it, maybe it just doesn't have such an impression on you. I don't know. But yeah, I know what you mean. You know, when I think of Steven Gerrard coming on and then getting sent off almost immediately in a Merseyside derby, I don't see that quite so much now.
Yeah, and I'm glad to see Gerrard not playing in a derby because he'd always inevitably annihilate us. But anyway, so the England job then. So you said you applied for it. Like, what made you? What? Why do you think you got that role?
Oh, I, God knows. I think it's a short answer. I think that, look, at that time, I'd worked in all four divisions of the professional game. You know, worked at a top club, worked at two top clubs, really. I worked in the Premier League, and I, you know, that was my experience. I mean, I don't know, I can't say why I got it, just because I don't know who else applied, really. But we, you know, went through an interview process, and then it took them ages to offer me the job. And I just thought, oh, well, you know, I can forget this. It's not happening. And then we were at an away game in somewhere like Manchester or Bolton or something. And they rung me up and said, you know, so then I had half an hour on the phone negotiating and stuff like that. It was, I don't like doing that sort of thing. I'm not very good at that. That's why I don't like doing it. But anyway, so, and then it was, when am I going to start? And I didn't really want to leave Arsenal. And then, you know, it was, anyway. I started in the February, and in 2009, my first game was Spain away. We lost 2-1, I think, or 2-0. But that was that was the start of that great Spanish team with Iniesta and Xavi and all those sort of players. But again, I didn't quite realise that. But yeah, it was interesting. It was an away game. And they said to me, so what do you think of, what's your first impressions? And I said, so many people around the team compared to when I'd been at Arsenal.
And what was like your day-to-day then with England then? Was it a full-time role?
Yeah, it was. Well, it wasn't. See, it's an interesting thing, really. It was a crazy business. It was head of medical services, really. So I did everything medical for the FA. So, you know, I was chief medical officer, if you like, for the FA, which is the governing body of football in this country. So there was always loads of stuff to do, all policy stuff, and then meetings, and then insurance stuff, and then preparing for tournaments, going away with the team, FIFA dates every year. So I'd be away from my desk. So I, you know, all that sort of stuff. It was, you know, people would send you pictures of a splint saying, you know, can I use this in the game at the weekend? I'd be able to, I maybe would say, for a 9-year-old that wanted to play in the under eights, you know, could he play under eights because this kid's got sort of, I don't know, a disability of some kind? Would it be okay for them to play a year down or a year up? So it was, yeah, it was absolutely full time. It was crazy, really. I mean, what they really needed was, and which they've got a chief medical officer and an England team doctor, and that's what you need, really.
Yeah, sounds a very diverse role, and if you get involved in all the governance side of things as well as the actual treatments.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, and, you know, when you're away with the team, that's the easy bit. You know, your pitch side, you're doing what you do. You know, that it is like it's always been. You know, you're looking after players, you're making sure all your drugs are up to date and all that sort of stuff. And then, you know, preparing for travel and, you know, injury and illness prevention while you're traveling. You know, what about going to a World Cup in Brazil when you've got to go to Manaus? You know, should we take anti-malarials? How does that work? How are we going to do it? You know, should we do it? How about immunisation? All that sort of stuff.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. Some of that stuff you don't always think about. You just think, yeah, you're doing some of the match day work. And
yeah,
there's a lot more beyond that. And so where were you based when you were doing that role?
Well, I've started Soho Square, but then we moved to Wembley pretty quickly. And, you know, I lived in Southeast London, so Southeast London to Wembley is a fair old trot. But that's, you know, I was on the fourth floor at Wembley, and that's, I shared an office with Gary Lewin. Look, they were great times, really. I mean, I wouldn't change any of that. I mean, it was very, you know, really enthralling and interesting thing to do. Work with great people, great practitioners who I still keep in contact with. And, you know, I worked with Fabio Capello, who was a real gent, and Roy Hodgson, of course, who, you know, I still keep in touch with. I did the Crystal Palace away game for Bournemouth, and, you know, it's nice to see Roy and Ray. So, yeah, you know what it's like. You bump into these people and you reminisce a bit, but it's just nice to see everybody doing okay.
Yeah, so Capello, then that's interesting, because you hear mixed reviews of different things with Capello, and that era was an interesting one. But I remember when he was appointed, it was like, wow, he's another absolute legend of the game going in there. So what was it like when you, so does he come in, did you go at the same time as him then? Because he was there, and who was there first?
He was. So he, and they were planning the 2010 World Cup when I started. And like Fabio, like I say, considering what he's done in the game and what, like you say, what a superstar he was a real gent, and, you know, never difficult with me. And I used to deal mainly with his deputy or his assistant, who was Franco Baldini. And again, I got on all right with Franco. You know, he used to take the mickey out of me. I used to take the mickey out of him. But, you know, I think in this sort of situation, you've just got to be truthful and straightforward with people. And, you know, if you think things aren't working out with a player, then you just have to say it. I mean, I don't think it's difficult. But, yeah, it's like everything. I got on really well with them both. But but as for Fabio, yeah, a gent.
Yeah, no, it's interesting insight. So what was South Africa like?
Well, yeah, long story, really. So they built a hotel resort for us near Rustenburg. And in theory, it was fantastic because you walked out of your room. You could walk across to the gym about 100 metres. If you turned right out of the hotel, the training pitch was there about 100 metres. It was a fantastic facility. But you know, there wasn't anything to do, and everyone, you know, not me, because, you know, there's always stuff for me to do, but all the players get a bit bored. There's nothing much else to do. We had the whole hotel to ourselves. Lovely hotel, nice food, clean, everything was fine. But it was just in the middle of nowhere, really.
And then, do you think it had an impact then on the players? I remember Rooney mentioning that as well, saying that they were quite bored with those sort of surroundings.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does have an impact. It's hard to know how, because, you know, each person deals with it in a different way. But, you know, they couldn't go for a walk down the street because we were in a very large compound. So, you know, everyone arranged a couple of days out for them, but you couldn't really do very much. And like I say, for me, it was relatively straightforward because there's always paperwork to do. So, and of course, in the first training session, Rio Ferdinand had a really nasty knee injury, and sorting that out and getting him home and doing everything was, you know, certainly took the first week up, that's for sure. So, you know, there was that. But like I say, it was a lovely place, but, you know, nothing else to do.
Yeah, and how did that compare to the other experiences at different tournaments then?
Well, the Euros in Poland, when that was Roy's first tournament, that was we had a small hotel, a boutique hotel, really, in the middle of the town, in the middle of Krakow. And that was really nice. And the hotel was nice. Food was nice. You know, the players could go out for a walk if they wanted to. So it was a little bit easier. The only problem there was all our games were in Kiev, and that was the luck of the draw. You know, when you go to these tournaments, you have to decide on the hotel you're at miles before the draw is made. So you don't know where your games are going to be. Like, for instance, in Brazil, we were in Rio. Our first game was in Manaus, which is 4.5-hour flight away in the middle of the jungle. So and with the Euros in Poland and Ukraine, all the games were in Kiev. So it was, that was difficult. But hey, you know, apart from that, that worked out very well. Brazil fine, but it's hard for players to go out for a walk in Rio just because they get mobbed all the time. So again, it's very difficult. You have to, you know, put on loads and loads and loads of things from to do within the hotel complex in order to keep them occupied. I mean, you know, these are young, fit guys that might train for an hour and a half, maximum 2 hours in the day. And then you've got the rest of the day when usually they'd be having, you know, a meal out with their partner. They'd be doing stuff, visiting friends, visiting family. Couldn't do any of that really. It was tough. Those tournaments are a bit like that. And not everybody manages it very well. I mean, it is an individual thing.
And then from your perspective then, and the medical team, do you get a chance to go out and experience it? You're in like Rio, you're in, you know, South Africa. It's like you're in these amazing places. Do you get to soak in any of like personal time?
Not much, really. I think that, you know, whenever you say to people, oh, yeah, you know, well, yeah, no, I went to the World Cup. Oh, that's been great. Well, yeah, you know, it's plane, bus, hotel, bus, training ground, bus, hotel. That's what it's like. You know, and for me, I think that I wasn't really that fussed about seeing much, but I think I always tried to stick around the hotel just in case someone needs you. The worst thing is, you know, you're away with the England team. You're at a World Cup. It's a fantastic thing. Someone gets ill. Oh, where are the medical staff? Oh, they're all out having coffee somewhere. You can't do that. So, yeah, someone always has to stay. And I really never minded doing that. Some of the guys will go out for a walk and a lot of them go out for a run in the morning. But there's usually not loads and loads of time to go out anywhere. And look, you know, if you're a pro footballer and you're playing for your country at a World Cup, and that's emotionally very taxing, and the doc comes and sees you in the middle of the night because you're ill and he smells of alcohol, it's not nice. So, yeah, I mean, it's just all work, Andy. That's all it is, really. But yeah, everyone thinks you see loads of stuff, and I always say you don't really. You see lots of buses, you see lots of planes and hotels and pitches. That's what it's like.
And what's the camaraderie? I was watching an interview with Frank Lampard, and he was chatting with, you know, Carragher and Neville, talking about England in that time, which I guess some of those players would still have been involved then.
Yeah.
So what was the dynamic like from your perspective?
No, always good, really. I think that, you know, I mean, if you, the scene is that, you know, you go, you're picked for England, and you may be a seasoned international, you may not be. If you're not, you know, you might be 20 or 21 and you're sitting down the end of the dining table. At the other end of the dining table are people with 70, 80, 90 caps. Emotionally very, you know, taxing. And, you know, we do fantastically well on measuring physical performance now and getting all the stats and how far everyone sprints and runs and all that. Do we measure emotional energy expenditure? We don't, because we don't know how to do it. We can't do it. So I think that given that, the camaraderie was always fun, you know. And in the medical room in the evening, if someone was having a soft tissue work, you know, there'd always be lots of banter going on. I always stayed out of banter because I wasn't very good at it, but a target a lot of the time, but not very good at it. So, yeah, I always stayed out. But yeah, I mean, most people, I'd say, I never really saw anyone have an argument the whole time I was there. It's really interesting. I know that people go on about that sort of thing, but I never saw it. All I saw was, you know, people trying to get on, trying to make the most of it, even though on Saturday before, you know, there may have been, like I said, a gladiatorial encounter between one team and another team. So, yeah, I think it was a nice environment. And look, the England staff always tried and I think succeeded in creating an environment where people could relax and enjoy themselves.
So on that note then, so do managers come to you and say, because you know that the treatment room can be a hotbed for people coming together and there's a lot of banter, as you say. So the managers ever say, giving you a role to be there as a team building or any sort of things like that?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, I think that, you know, it depends on the manager and how they see. I mean, sometimes they'd say, you know, how are the lads? How is everybody? But most of the time, because they've got a team of coaches around them, they rely on them to give them that sort of information. Whereas I, you know, it's football's a funny sort of business, really. It's a top-down business, and it's, you know, the way that the manager wants it usually is how it is. I'm an advisor, really. That's where I think I sit. You know, I'm not the player's mate. I'm not the manager's mate. Definitely not, neither of those things. And I sit in the middle, and I try and, you know, I'll pass feelings, messages maybe across, but not in a way to undermine anybody, just to try and help the flow of communication. But I definitely don't get involved in, you know, being an advocate for one or the other, because, you know, the manager and the player have a relationship that doesn't involve me. You know, the manager will pick the player and the player will perform for the manager. And if I get stuck in the middle, I'm the one who gets squeezed out. And I don't mind getting squeezed out. It's just that, you know, you just cause more noise. And what you're trying to do is calm that extra noise down and make it into an environment where people can perform to their best.
And have you felt like you've been able to achieve that relatively successfully?
No, not really. I mean, sometimes I think I do, but on reflection, I don't know that I make that much difference, Andy. You know, it's always attractive to think, oh, yeah, you know, I did that and it was really good. Yeah, fine, maybe, but not for me to say. And, you know, I just sort of try and keep to where I think I should be. I hope that a manager can come to me and say something and not feel like I'm going to pass on confidential stuff to players. Same for players. I don't want the player thinking, you know, he's going to go and tell the manager. And if I am going to tell the manager, I tell the player exactly what I'm going to say and make sure that what I'm going to say and the words I use are the words that the player is happy with. Then there's nothing unsaid, nothing, you know, the player doesn't have to worry that I'm, you know, making things difficult for them.
Yeah, I can see it's a fine balancing act.
Yeah.
And then so what? How did the time at England come to an end? And what did you go on to do?
Well, yeah. So we had a performance director come in, and he wanted to change things. And we went to the Euros in France in 2016, as you know, famously lost to Iceland. I was sitting on the bench as the game went on and nudging Gary Lewin, saying, "Gaz, it's 2-1. It's 2-1, Gaz." And he's going, "Yeah, I know. And as the time went on and on and on, because the score didn't change, Roy and Ray resigned at the end of that game. And we'd all been, I mean, I knew we were going to get made redundant. So that's what happened. All the jobs went from Wembley to St George's Park. And ostensibly, that's the reason why they didn't keep us on. But look, I think they wanted to make a change, and they're allowed to do that. I mean, that's what performance directors do. They come in and they make changes. That's what they get paid for. So that's what they did. So I started working for Man City. I used to go once a week to their academy and work there, and started to do the City Football Group stuff, which was their global teams. So that was, you know, again, very interesting, great people. And very Grant Downey was my sort of boss, really. And he was a great line manager and very organized, and ran the academy fantastically well. So it was interesting to be there. And, you know, it was, like I say, nice people. And I had to go to Manchester every week, which is never easy for a southerner. But yeah, but seriously, what the nice thing about it was, I got to see Manchester and you know, got to like it, which was a surprise to me, really. But yeah, it was I liked working there. And I'm only just finishing up the City Football Group stuff. You know, I think we did in the summer, I did about 50 online medicals with them, with the teams around the world for them. So all that stuff, very interesting, very engaging.
It's really impressive, isn't it? Again, what they've done is really taken it to the next level of different teams in different countries, and that the Etihad campus is just unbelievable.
Oh, I mean, the Etihad campus, every time I go there, I say to people, you see this is why Manchester City have to win the league every year. Every cone, every small goal in the indoor pitches, everything is just right and all put away properly and all stacked properly and all tidy. Nothing is, you know, you always see staff cleaning. You know, you don't walk past anywhere and there's a little corner where there's grubby stuff. It's all clean. It's all done properly. Food's lovely. I mean, it is an impressive outfit.
So when you get in that role there, like what was your experience like? Like you've obviously impressed with the setup and how they were doing things. What did you take away from your interactions with the recruitment process and then working there?
Well, I think that so when I was with England, Sam Erith came with us for the Euros in France. And he was talking to me about going and working there. And I said, well, yeah, you know, I'd like to do that. Anyway, so that's how I sort of was recruited for there. And as far as, are you talking about recruiting of players?
No, feet for you, really. Just like your experience
yeah, so
of it.
That's how I got it, really. And then I think I was sort of hanging around. And then the City Football Group stuff started with Cherry Daly. She used to lead the unit. And so I just started giving them some advice and working with them. And Grant Downey and I went away to we went to China. You know, we went to Yokohama to see them and do a sort of an audit for them. Scott McAllister, who's here at Bournemouth, we've been away to Girona a few times and done stuff with them and to Troyes in France. So all that, so that's how that sort of worked, you know, trying to help them with governance really and it sounds very grand, say how to run a medical team and a club. I don't mean it like that. What I mean is, you know, what standards are there that there should be in order to keep players safe, staff safe, and the club and the brand safe. You know, I've had this discussion today here. You know, that's what governance is to me. You know, it's very important. Of course, players are the most important thing. But then if something goes wrong, it's often the staff that suffer. So how can we protect them as well? And then the club and the brand. And the brand for City is a worldwide brand. It isn't. So if someone has a cardiac event in Yokohama, someone will find out that it's they have allegiances with the City Football Group and start to write about why City Football Group haven't helped them out with their governance and with their first aid policy, for instance.
No, it is really interesting, and it's, you can see again why their sustained success. Did you have much dealings with that, the management team?
No, not really. I mean, you know, and I'm keen not to, and I'm keen. People say, oh, it must be great. I don't see the first team. I don't want to see the first team. I'm not interested in it. And the reason is that, you know, I'm like everybody else, really. You know, that these people, I love watching them play football because I think that's what I call proper football. So I don't want to know who they are, really, in a way. You know, I've got a job in that organisation. I do that job. I try and do that as well as I can. And the rest of it will look after itself. Actually, as it turns out, you know, I don't need to be involved in the first team. It's not essential.
And then, so what other jobs have you been doing whilst you've been doing at the City Football Group?
Oh, you know, I worked at the Royal Ballet, and I started there early 2000s. I've only just finished a couple of months ago. I sort of thought it's about time I let them get on with it. And that was interesting. Again, people say ballet and football, not very similar. They're very similar. It's all about performance. It's all about fitness. It's all about the drive that the individual has at the top level. And that, you know, I always find that impressive. I'm not sure I got that, but I've seen a lot of people that have it, and it's great to see. And, you know, ballet is just an interesting thing, you know, it's proper art on the stage, I think. So, yeah, so I've done that. And I think that's about it, really. I don't know what else I've done, to be honest with you. Bits and bobs. You know, I went to Al Jazeera and looked at their academy and the governance there. So I'm trying to help them set up a proper governance structure so that they don't, again, run foul of, you know, a disaster happening and people not knowing what to do and how to do it.
And then you spent, Aspetar?
Oh, yeah. I was at Aspetar for 2 years. So this is really funny. Jan Ekstrand rung me up. We were wrapping presents. At Christmas time, and Jan Ekstrand rang me up, and I knew it was him because I knew him from UEFA. And I said, oh, you know, He said, oh, you know, we're doing this. Do you want to come out and work here? And I said to him, do you know how old I am, Jan? And he said, yes, yes, I know. Yeah, anyway, so my wife and I went out and did an interview with them. You know, my wife came into the interview with me and we co-interviewed. The first question I asked them was, so how do you manage national identity? Because, you know, in the UK, Priti Patel and everybody, they're going on about, you know, we've got a tsunami of people coming in and national identity. So I asked them how they managed it, because there's only 300,000 Qataris and 2 million expats. And they said, oh, you know, we don't even think much about it, really. We just get on with our lives and the expats do what they do. So it's very interesting. So Alison and I did the interviews together, and then I went and worked out there. And it was supposed to be as a football dock. But then within 2-3 months of being there, COVID struck. They shut the country, and that was that, really. And they were only really just opening. I stayed 2 years, you know, on my own. And most of the time, you know, they still had COVID restrictions until about 3 or 4 months before I left. I was supposed to stay till the World Cup, but I didn't do that. But I was a pitch side doc for the World Cup for FIFA. And the under 17 Women's World Cup in Mumbai, I did as well. So that was, you know, they're always interesting, you know, teaching people how to do pitch side care or assessing them and then working the games and making sure that people are evacuated safely. So it's fun, interesting.
Yeah, what's it like? I've not been to Aspetar, so I'm really fascinated to go at some point. What's the setup like of there and the country itself?
Yeah, it's fine. I mean, you know, people say, oh, you know, I wouldn't want to go there. I can't have a drink. You can drink anywhere. You know, every hotel's got 5 bars. You can get a drink. The eating out's lovely. The people at Aspetar are fantastic. I think they're really good practitioners, very nice people. Because most of them are expats, you're all looking after each other, because you know, everyone knows what the situation is. You know, and Peter Doog, who's the chief medical officer, has always used to say to me, in the end, everyone goes home. So, but yeah, good practitioners, good researchers, very helpful people. Good facilities. Not absolutely state of the art, facilities, but, you know, they make good use of what they've got. And like I say, pretty dedicated practitioners. But it was nice to work there. You know, you start work at 8 in the morning, you finish at 4 in the afternoon. You know, most people have left the hospital by 5. But, you know, and it's always warm, of course. You know, that's one thing that's nice about it. But you don't go out much you can't walk anywhere. You've got to go in a car everywhere. I liked it there. You know, I wouldn't mind going working in Saudi for a few months, but my family say I'm not doing that, so I won't be doing it if I got the opportunity. But yeah, so I liked Aspetar, and I like the people, and still keep in touch with them.
Yeah, Carl Todd's out there, and a few of the guys have gone, haven't they?
Carl Todd's in Saudi. Yeah, he is.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. I think a few of the guys have gone over, haven't they? Jordan's gone with them as well.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't have minded doing that at all. But like I said, I spoke to the family about it, and they said, you know, Dad, come on, be sensible. So it was Bournemouth for me, which at least is only just down the road.
Which is a great city as well. I love Bournemouth. Great.
Yeah, it's nice here. I mean, for goodness sake, you know, I mean, we're very lucky to live here. You know, we're near the sea, near the countryside, no traffic that you know of in a big city. So it's lovely. It's a nice place to live.
And then, so what would you say, just wrapping up, in terms of like the non-clinical skills for you to be successful, or however you define success, but to be a good practitioner within sports medicine or have a good career, what would you say that the non-clinical skills that are needed?
I think that you have to try and understand that, you know, athletes, whether they're single athletes or team athletes, or stage performers, you know, it's all down to them. You have to understand that. So you have to try and see it from their point of view. You have to think that, you know, like I said, we measure physical performance and physical expenditure easily now. You know, we've got GPS, we know everything. What emotional expenditure is there? We haven't got any idea. And what it must be like to run out, you know, in front of 50,000 people and everyone expects you to perform. I don't know what that's like. I haven't got any idea. So I think you have to try and think about what that is. And every time you feel like you want to say no, take a step back and say, look, let's just have a look at all the possibilities here. In I think in professional sport, and this is the same in dance, you have to be able to bend with the wind a bit. So, you know, it's not the same as when you're sitting in a clinic with someone who say, oh, you must do this and you must do that. If you're a physio, you say, well, you know, you've got to do this exercise. This is how you do it. You know, that sort of thing isn't going to work in a football club. If the manager says, I think he can play, and you say, well, look, I don't think he can play. And the manager will say, well, I've asked him and he says he's OK. Your job then isn't to say, well, if you're going to say that, then I'm walking out. That isn't your job. Your job is to say, OK, these are the risks. And as long as you're aware of the risks, look, you know, OK, as long as the player isn't going to drop dead, you know, then it's, but you have to make everyone aware of what the risks are, because you're always pushing. You're always pushing the boundaries. And, you know, to be honest, that's the thing that I find most exciting, really. You're pushing the boundaries. And most of the time, I don't know where I am. I think I know where I am, but I don't think I always do. And because when I reflect on it, I think, oh, I didn't realize that. So be able to see it from everyone's point of view. Be able to bend just a bit. You know, I'm not saying do anything that's dangerous. I'm saying try and understand what the drivers are for other people in your situation. And bear in mind that if you're a doc, you're a physio, you're not the most important person here. That's, again, that's not an easy thing. You know, if you're a doctor, most of the time you're taught how important you are. And you, when you work in sport, you realize, you actually, you know what, I'm not that important at all. Most of the time, no one gives a toss who I am. So, and that's good, because that means everything's going well and they don't need anything from me. But you have to be like that. Otherwise, you know, you're never going to be satisfied. It's always going to be too difficult.
Yeah, no, good answer. And then what would you advise me for people who do want to get into this area?
Okay, so if you want to be I think the thing to do is to, I was very lucky. I started at Leighton Orient, you know, not big demands. So get in touch with your local football club, you know, lower division, and say, you know, I want a career in this. Can I come along and see what you do and maybe help out? And every now and again, you know, the doc there or someone is going to say, well, so-and-so can't make it this week, or the doc is ill. Can you sit in for us? That's how you start. And just see what happens and see how it goes and see what compromises people have to make it work, because that's what it's like. And then once you get that, then you can start. You've got to have, in football, go and get your ATMIF. Not easy. And then say, look, I'm pitch side trained now. I can come and help you out. And then, you know, you might want to do, you know, if you manage to do 10 games a year, that might be enough for you for the first few years. Because, you know, you don't, working every game and being on call 24 hours a day, you know, it's hard. It's hard if you've got a family. And that's the other thing. Be aware that professional sport happens at weekends. If you've got a family and a young family, often it's, you know, seeing them and spending time with them is a sacrifice you have to make.
Yeah, great. And well, on that note, you've got a game tonight. So what have you got to do before the match?
Oh, take all the stuff over to the room in the other stand where the dressing room is. Make sure I've been through all my drugs this morning and make sure I've got everything I might need, because that's the worst thing, is to turn up and then you have the insecurity of thinking, oh, I forgot so-and-so. And all you can do is think about the fact that you might need it, even if you don't.
Great. No, well, Ian, really appreciate your time. Thanks for sharing and good luck in the game tonight.
Thanks a lot, mate. Good to see you and good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.